So you can even go beyond this. And not only were you designed to do this, but you can go a little even Muhammad Ali on and go, you're the greatest, because no other creature on the planet is as good at what you're doing when you're running long distances as you are.
I took a little bit of time off from running, and I went running last week, and it felt like I was unleashing a caged animal. I felt like I had gone back to my roots, and I was just out there, and I was, the air in my lungs, it just felt amazing.
It does sound kind of creepy the way you're sort of walking around eyeing other people's legs.
I was going to say, now let's get into the big hefty butts. Now we're talking about my anatomy. Joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Faith Goss.
And today we have author extraordinaire Chris McDougall, who is not only an author, but he's also a runner. He is the author of the national bestseller, Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. Tonight with us, we have the hard copy, we have a soft copy, and we have the audio version of that book. So we're trying to feed Christopher's family. So thanks for joining us, Chris.
Oh, good to be here, guys. And Faith.
One of the things that we wanted to focus on this podcast is most of the interviews that we've heard and seen with you, Chris, kind of focus on the barefoot running and the tribe down in Mexico. What we wanted to do is kind of skew it a little bit differently and talk about the way that we are designed as humans to run long distances.
You know, I'm so glad too because it really caught me by surprise that this became the barefoot running book, because nobody in the book runs barefoot. And I never really imagined that being one of the calling cards of Born to Run.
Right. You know, as I look at that book, I think chapter 28, I think chapters 1 through 27, and then the chapters on the other side of 28 are there just to protect that beautiful chapter number 28. That's what they're there for. Now, you've got great stories all the way through that book. You've got great stories about the tribe, about different running characters in there, and the book is engaging on many different levels. But that chapter 28, when we talk about how we as people are just born to run, I just love it.
And I love the fact that it's like 280 pages of protective cushioning all for those individual.
That's right. So, as you know, Chris, when I'm out there running and really what we hope to, at least I kind of hope to bring across to some of the Trail Runner Nation listeners is this. I'm running down the trail, and this enters my mind often, and it was because of chapter 28, that, you know, I'm supposed to be out here. This is what my DNA, this is what my ancestors prepared me to do. In fact, this is really the sole reason I'm here, is because we were built and very efficient to become runners. And so maybe not sitting behind computers all day long and not doing different types of activities we may be doing, but truly runners.
You know, last night I was out for a trail run with my local trail running club, and it was a really super foggy night and drizzly, misty, so foggy that your headlamp is kind of reflected back at you. You're not getting any illumination at all.
Oh, yeah.
And we set off on a trail that I knew was really, really gnarly, technical, rocky. And I said, there's no way anybody's going to 50 yards without busting an ankle. We ended up doing an hour and a half run. Everybody was just flying. Nobody got hurt. Barely anybody even fell. And I thought about it afterwards. I thought, man, that's it. That's the human animal just doing what it does. There's no intellectual control over that at all. We were running blind on rocks in the dark, and everyone was just flying.
Well, and I think it helps me psychologically when I'm out there running for long distances, and just you can have those thoughts of negativity creep in, to, you know, saying, what am I doing out here? You know, why it hurts, you know, what am I doing out here? And I always think, come back to the chapter 28 that says, I'm designed to do this. My body is designed to do this, whether it's my butt or my feet or the ligament in my neck. I'm designed to do this.
Now you can even go beyond this. Not only were you designed to do this, but you can go a little even Muhammad Ali on and go, you're the greatest, because no other creature on the planet is as good at what you're doing when you're running long distances as you are.
Yeah, you know, I'm coming back from a knee injury, and I took a little bit of time off from running, and I went running last week, and it felt like I was unleashing a caged animal. I felt like I had gone back to my roots, and I was just out there, and I was, the air in my lungs, it just felt amazing.
Hey, Chris, can we talk about some of those very characteristics that make us, you know, born to run? About the skin and about so many great things that you mentioned in there. I know you know them. So can you just walk us through some of these characteristics of the human being that allows us to be efficient runners?
Well, you know, let me if you don't mind, let me tell you the story the way it unfolded for me, because yeah. All of this anthropological research came as pretty much a surprise for me, because you know the whole chronology, the way this whole thing took place was, you know, I first heard about this tribe, I was intrigued, I got a Runner's World article out of it, so I went down to sort of check them out, and I realized I was only seeing the tip of the iceberg, that there's a lot more here to be discovered, and so I was able to train and then return for the race that I described in the book. And I know I never really knew that there was going to be a race. Up until the moment we got down to the canyon, I was pretty sure that nobody was going to turn up, least of all the Tarahumara, for this race. So I really wasn't intending to write a book. I thought that I would get a magazine story out of it, and that would be the end of it. Excuse me. It was only when I came back that I was so electrified by what I'd experienced that I started to do a deep dive into the research. And that's what led me to the University of Utah. And that is basically ground zero for where all this research began. It all began with a guy who wasn't even a professor at the time. He was just a graduate student. It was David Carrier who started fooling around with this idea about humans as long-distance runners. And it was his thinking that got his mentor, Dr. Dennis Bramble, to come up with the big brainstorm, which I feel is like sort of the big light bulb which explains all of animal existence on the planet. What it all comes down to is fuel efficiency. All about getting air into the system. And that's what all evolution has been all about. You know, as creatures evolve, they become more and more fuel efficient, which that means is they become more and more effective at getting air into their system, which allows them to burn calories, which allows them to move their muscles, which allows them to move through space. And once you get that one notion, it's all about sucking in air, then suddenly everything else starts to fall into place.
And it was actually interesting that you describe in the book that when the graduate student, David Carrier, started, you know, looking at this rabbit and looking at all the different types of autonomy or anatomy of this rabbit, and then he went to his professor, Dr. Bramble. Dr. Bramble kind of laughed at him and said, you're crazy. We're not born to run. We're the slowest, skinniest, most inefficient running machine there is, and he finally got him convinced to believe his theory, right?
Yeah, you know, one of the really cool things about dealing with academics who are not in the limelight is you get such awesome access at times to some of these great minds. So when I started to do this research, I contacted Drs. Carrier and Bramble and said, would you mind if I came out to Salt Lake? And you guys just sort of talked me through your theories. And they said, yeah, sure, go on out. So I got to spend a couple of days just hanging out there with these guys in their labs. David Carrier, after showing me how they run guinea hens on a treadmill in his lab, and then skinned on a pair of shorts, and let's go for a run. So, you know, half an hour later, he and I are running through the Wasatch Mountains together. He sees this little wolf spider, you know, a really venomous wolf spider. He gets down there and he starts, like, tease it with a stick because wolf spiders can hold the air in their abdomen be fascinating. He's like doing lab work out there in the mountains. But what got him started, again, to me, this is such a, you know, you can't pay money for an experience like that, to be there with the guy who thought it up, who takes you out into the hills to show you how it all took place. But what his first revelation was, he was dissecting a rabbit, and he's looking at the lung apparatus, and he sees a couple of things which he thinks shouldn't be there. You know, there's these extra springy bones attached just below the thorax. And you look at these things and think, well, why are they here? You know, they're sort of extraneous bones. And he started sort of playing around with them, and he realized they operated sort of like a bellows that you use for a fireplace. They would actually expand and contract and open the lungs and close them again. Then he started playing around a little bit of math, and what he realized was exactly the point where a rabbit would hit its lactate threshold and not be able to go much faster, much further, is exactly enough time to get the cover before a larger predator could run it down. Mm-hmm. So rabbits have exactly enough advantage to escape a larger prey, and the larger prey, on the other hand, we have just enough margin of error that every once in a while they would catch a rabbit. It's a wonderful, delicate balance, but once again, it's all based on oxygen. You know, that if the rabbit burns up all of its oxygen before finding cover, it's dead, and the predator, if it can actually force this thing to run a little bit further than it can actually breathe comfortably, it's got a fat meal. So this is his thinking. He's like, man, it's all about running some breathing. That's what he took to Dr. Bramble. And as you said, Dr. Bramble came from the conventional thinking about human evolution was that we are walkers and carriers, that we're essentially locomotion devices for our arms. You know, the only reason you got legs is to basically move your arms from place to place so you can pick stuff up and take it somewhere else. So to have this notion of running, it just seems stupid. But you know, again, Bramble, super cool guy, super smart. He started to play around with this, and then that's what took him to the next breakthrough, which is that he started to find stuff on the human body which really shouldn't be there. Kind of the same way David Carrier found those like wacky little wing things under the thorax of a rabbit, Bramble starts finding stuff on the human body that really shouldn't be there for walkers. They should only be there for runners.
What kind of things did he find?
Well, the first thing was a thing called the, real simple, first of all, it's the Achilles tendon. Certain animals have them, certain animals don't. Chimpanzees, our closest animal relatives, don't have Achilles tendons. They're heels. The Achilles tendon really serves no purpose except for running and jumping. It doesn't help you at all. It doesn't help you with walking at all. And anything you shouldn't have that you have is a drawback. You know, you don't want to be carrying around excess weight or excess cargo because it makes you less efficient. So if you've got Achilles tendons and they're only good for creating elastic recoil in a running animal, then you must be close to a running animal. The next thing he didn't even realize until he went to see Dr. Daniel Lieberman at Harvard University. Now, Lieberman is an anthropologist who's working on his own studies, and he was running a pig on a treadmill. And he kept wondering, why is it that the pig's head just keeps, you know, rolling around? And that's when Bramble made the connection. He said, the reason why the pig's head is rolling around is because it doesn't have a nuchal ligament. A nuchal ligament is, again, just a ligament that runs behind your neck up in your head, and it only serves one purpose. It keeps your head steady when you're running. Pigs are not really runners, you know, they only do short bursts. And you actually sort of see it. If you ever watch like the movie like Babe, you watch a pig's head that's, you know, spinning all over the place when it runs. Humans have a nuchal ligament, which allows it to stabilize the head when we're running long distances.
Well, you know, I like what you're telling me about the Achilles tendon, because I've always had calf envy. My calves are high, and I've always looked at those people with large calves and go, man, I wish I had those. But now that I know the Achilles tendon and all that tendinous structure that isn't wasted at all, I really need these high calves. And that keeps me light below the knee and a lot of tendinous, elastic, springy structure that keep me going down the trail. So for all you guys with those big calves, I've got the small ones and I'm happy about it. We love the research.
I'm glad you found, I'm glad you found peace with yourself.
I need it. It's been taking me a long time. I got it.
Now let's talk.
It does sound kind of creepy the way you're sort of walking around eyeing other people's legs.
I was going to say, now let's get into the big hefty butts. Now we're talking about my anatomy.
Well, yeah, I think you do bring something about that in there, about what our glutes are for running. Maybe you can hit on that a little bit, Chris.
Yeah, that was a Daniel Lieberman point. It still humbles me and startles me that I had such access to a guy like Daniel Lieberman. This guy is, you know, head of evolutionary biology at Harvard University. He's got a million things going on. He's written a book on the human head that is literally like 900 pages long. And to be able to ask this guy questions was such a privilege. But one of the points that Daniel Lieberman explained to me is that, you know, again, chimpanzees, they don't have butts at all. They're totally flat-butted. The butt only really plays a role for running. It doesn't serve any other purpose. And he said, you can sort of check this out. If you sort of grab your own butt while you're walking around, it sort of stays flabby. But when you either run or jump, you feel that gluteus maximus muscle start to really clench. You know, for me, though, this was a really good instructional point as well. It was a great biological point. But for me, I'm constantly thinking and tinkering with running form, trying to get it right. Mm-hmm. And once you realize what a big role your glutes play in your running form, to me it became a reminder. Like if my glutes aren't active, if I don't feel them when I'm running, that means I'm probably dragging my leg. I'm not lifting up. And so you start to become aware of this, not just as a academic point, but as a style point.
So I'm picturing you running around the trails with both hands on the back of your butt. It's kind of a weird running form,
while you're
Chris.
While you're staring at my calves.
I'm staring at the calves. Scott's staring at your butt. Okay, let's keep it straight.
I'm also think that this is a great excuse to go around and grab other people's butts.
All right, we're not running together.
I wanted to ask a question, getting back to the breathing. You said something about the better you are at breathing, the better you are at running. And I'm wondering if you can kind of cross-train your lungs. I do, when I cross-train, I swim. And I do some, like, underwater stuff where I'll do, like, one whole lap when I'm not breathing. And I feel like that really helps me in my running capacity. Do you do anything to, you know, help your lungs, like, kind of train your lungs?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't. But what I do, you know, Dr. Mark Cucuzella, who's a guy that you've got to have on sometime, because not only is he a sensational runner, but super smart guy, and he is doing more to research this than just about anybody else who's not being paid for it. But, you know, Mark Cucuzella was telling me that whenever he is in a race, and the guy's still banging out like 239, 236 marathons at age 47. But he says that in the middle of the race, when he starts to get tired, he just focuses on elongating his torso and making sure he's like breathing from the navel. You know, just getting the breath in and out from the lowest point in his torso he possibly can. And that's the only sort of training I've done, is that when I start to get tired on a run, I realize that I start to hunch over a little bit. You know, your shoulders start to come down towards your knees, and you start to do a rib cage breathe. And I try to do the same thing. I try to straighten up and then breathe deeply from the belly, and it just changes everything. Suddenly, it's like getting an extra tank of gas in your car. It feels like everything is better fueled. So rather than training the lung capacity, I try to train like the lung efficiency, you know, to use the lungs to their maximum capability.
In that wonderful chapter 28, Chris, the most beautiful chapter in that book, you do talk about diaphragm and multiple breaths per step, how we're efficient runners because we have a unique ability as standing upright to do something different than many of the other running creatures. True?
Yeah, that's a really cool thing. Again, this is something that, again, it sort of startles you that people never bothered to examine this before. But when doctors Carrier and Bramble, I mean, and the wacky experiments these guys do too, is like, you know, hey, we should check out a horse. Let's get a horse. Let's bring a horse on the treadmill. A horse in the lab on the treadmill. But what they started to do is, you know, you can't have the horse running by itself. So David Carrier will be running alongside the horse while the horse is running on its own treadmill. And what Dr. Bramble noticed while he was looking at this, it was not only stride length, but also breathing rates. He noticed that almost every other running mammal is pretty much locked into a one stride, one breath ratio. You know, stride for breath, stride for breath. Humans, on the other hand, can vary up and down. And what they found most common was two strides per breath. So, you know, it's a left-right breath, instead of, you know, tum, tum, tum. It basically gave us, you know, many more gears in our gearbox, but also the ability to become more relaxed and more efficient as we get more tired.
As we look at the back in time during the evolutionary period, we have the, and you touch on this in the book, is that human erectus and the Neanderthal, where the Neanderthal is strong, you know, powerful, and appears to have every advantage over this weaker, slimmer, wimpier, slower animal, yet one survives and one doesn't. And that very concept right there is what gives me power to just keep on going on those long runs, because I know those are my ancestors. Talk to us about that, Chris. Empower me. Let your words run through my head. So take me, I've read the book, I've listened to the audio, but now let me hear the author of this book drill this into my skull so I can recall it on these long runs.
We have some big runs planned tomorrow, so motivate us.
Here comes in all its poetic glory.
Yeah, great.
My concept of Neanderthal prior to researching this was, I thought these were the short, fat, hairy, gorilla-like dudes who were running around with big clubs, bashing like mastodons and women on the head and dragging them both back to the cave. That was my concept. And I also assumed that they were pretty much heading stage left when Homo erectus was showing up. I didn't realize that they coexisted for more than 100,000 years. And secondly, that they were actually superior to us in almost every way. You know, not only were they bigger and stronger, but they were way better hunters. They actually probably had a larger cranial capacity, so they might have had a larger brain. There is no indication that they were not capable of speech, because the construction of their throats and necks and brains would have made them capable of speech. There's evidence from the fossil record that they were highly socialized, that they actually cooked and cared for their sick and their ill. So, you know, all the things I would have assumed would have marked them out for extinction, you know, that they were dumber or they couldn't communicate as well or they were more savage, the opposite is true. They were actually more advanced than we were. So you start to run down the checklist of what are the shortcomings which would slate you for extinction. These guys are getting straight A's. They're not failing any of the subjects. So what was it? The only thing which comes to mind has to do with the end of the Ice Age. You know, during the Ice Age, you've got these big, thick, overgrown, really humid forests. Great place to run ambushes and close, contained kind of hunting. But suddenly, when these forests start to die down and recede, and what you have is big, hot, sun-baked, open savanna, you know, suddenly you have these big, muscular guys who are retaining more body heat. They're shaggier and hairier, so they're not, you know, perspiring as freely and efficiently as humans are. And secondly, they're just not equipped to run long distances. So suddenly, the game changed from a close quarters, close combat kind of hunting into long range running. And here you got the guys, you know, basically it's the freshman cross country team is suddenly way better than the offensive line of the football team.
You know, and you talk about David Carrier's theory that he can outrun an antelope and catch an antelope if he just runs long enough.
Yeah, you know, this is what was so cool at working on this book was, even when you think you're getting into what's going to be dry, technical, academic stuff, all of a sudden, you know, you get this jaw-dropping story you never expected. So, you know, again, I'm talking to anthropologists in Utah and I'm concerned about getting the facts straight. And then all of a sudden, they start telling me this, you know, awesome story about one brother calling the other and saying, hey, look, you know, get my PhD. I need to go to Wyoming and chase after some antelope. Are you in? And, of course, the brother's like, yeah, sure. So, and off they go. You hear that whole bizarre saga, these two brothers and their buddies, Jason, you know, Antelope Around Wyoming. But then, again, that one key ingredient, the one thing that they didn't realize they're missing is how do you figure out which goddamn antelope it is you're trying to catch? And it leads us back to another guy that nobody had ever heard of, you know, Lou Liebenthal in South Africa. This is a guy that was just on his own fascinated with how human thought began. He's like, okay, I can figure out how we got the hardware. I understand how the brain developed, but how did the mind develop? And his theory was it all came back to that first moment when we started to track animals. Because, you know, tracking is an abstract science. You're trying to do predictive thought. You're trying to take information you're seeing and abstract it into a different result. And that's a high, it's kind of a high brain function. So, you know, he's out in the savannah with the Kalahari Bushmen. And again, strictly by surprise, one morning he's like sleeping in the tent and the Bushmen wake him up, say, hey man, grab some water, let's go, we're going off for a hunt. And he knows they weren't carrying any weapons, just water jugs. And they started to do something he'd heard about, but had never seen before, which is called a persistence hunt. And a persistence hunt is just that. You get out there and you keep persisting and keep running until whatever you're chasing drops over dead. Now, I hope that motivates you guys for your run tomorrow. Just imagine whoever's going to be ahead of you in your age group in a race, imagine that guy keeling over dead in front of you.
In fact, in around that space, I believe in the book you make this quote, if you can run 6 miles in the heat, you are a lethal weapon.
Isn't that cool? Lethal weapon.
Yeah.
That was basically it. The idea was, and you know, when they started to track how long it takes, it's a surprisingly short amount of time. You can run an antelope to death on a hot day, sometimes in as few as 60 minutes, anywhere from an hour to 4 hours is what it takes to drop one of these things.
I believe in and around that chapter, you talk about the reason that we may be assembling in tens of thousands to run for 3 to 5 hours in a marathon, maybe genetically based or in our DNA as hunters, we seem to fall into that 3 to 5 hour recreational event.
Yeah, that was a great quote from Dr. Bramble. I think he said something like recreation has its reasons.
Yeah.
You know, why? I mean, think about this too. If you're up in a space shuttle looking down at planet Earth and all of a sudden you saw any other species gathering by the tens of thousands at like 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning and somebody started running in the streets, you know, you think there's some kind of like mass panic or mass migration. But, you know, we do this all the time. We gather 40, 50,000 of us at a time to run for anywhere from, you know, 2 to 5 hours, which, again, exactly corresponds to the average time it takes to run a kudu or antelope to death.
Well, you know, and another thing that is very fascinating that helps me when I'm out there is that not only are we born to run, but it's not just the young, you know, the 18, 19, 20-year-olds that are out there running. It's, you know, in these ultra races that we participate in, you know, the average age, I think, is like 40, 45. And you bring up the fact that, and I want you to tell the statistic or and explain it, but, you know, if we started running at 18, we reach our peak at like 25, and then we slowly lose our speed until, you know, but it's much, much slower. Can you explain that?
Yeah, that was a cool thing. So I was sitting in Dr. Bramble's lab, and he had just gotten the results back from his study, and he's holding it face down on the table, and he gets a little smile on his face. And he's like, all right, we just got these results back. Let me ask you this. A little math puzzle for you. Get a pencil out, do some math. So he goes, most marathons, the youngest you can be to run most marathons is 19 years old. That was like the starting age for the New York City Marathon. I don't know if it still is, but it was for a number of years. So they started to track the average finishing times of runners starting at age 19. And what they found is, on average, you start running the marathon at age 19, you will get progressively faster for 8 years until you reach age 27. That's when you hit your peak. After age 27, on average, people will gradually get a little bit slower, a little bit slower, year by year, until eventually they're back to running the same speed they were running at age 19. So you think, okay, you know, you take a guess, K 19, peak at 27, maybe it takes you 10 years to come off your peak, so you got 37. I mean, that makes sense. You know, late 30s, you're back to running the same pace you were when you started. So you round up a little bit, let's call it 40. So I took a guess. Yeah, we're about 40, and he's sort of shaking his head. I'd check 50, 55. No, it's 64 years old. It takes you 45 years before you're back to running the same speed you were at age 19.
I like the sound of that, Chris McDougall.
Well, you know, what's cool about it, too, is I brought this up once with Andy Burfoot, and he said, well, you know, it's funny. You know, his mentor, John Kelly. You know, John Kelly was running the almost identical marathon times in the Boston Marathon for something like 25 years after his glory days. You know, everyone knows his glory days when he was, you know, always contender to win. But for the next 25 years, the dude was banging out the same, like, 2:45 time over and over and over again until he was in his 50s.
So the field of running, ultra running especially, is rapidly growing. And what I found really funny about the TED speech, and I just had to bring this up, you said until the 1980s, women were not supposed to be running long distances for fear of their uterus falling out. And I just stopped dead in my tracks and I was cracking up out loud, especially as women enter the field of running and ultra running. The field is growing, and these women are, I guess, defying science, you know, going out and running these long distances and kicking butt at it. You know, the field is ever changing and ever growing, and I just found that a really funny part of your TED Talk.
And what she's referring to is for our listeners, if you're not familiar, is there is a speech. I don't even know what the organization is, but if you go to TEDTV.com and put in the search engine Christopher McDougall, it'll pop up, and it's a great speech that Christopher did.
We'll link it.
Yeah.
And I think that's something you could, you know, listen to before a run for inspiration. There were some pretty inspirational stories you told as part of that speech.
Yeah, that whole Duarte Tulu story was something that just still sends shivers up my spine. You know, it was just such a great moment in running history. But, yeah, you know, the thing about that was, you know the takeaway I got from this whole experience of researching this book was the sort of depressing truth that, man, a lot of the stuff we're told and we accept as science is just baloney. You know, it's like they don't know what they're talking about. And to think that women were not allowed to run the Olympic marathon from 1982, you know, like I was in college and they were not, was I? Yeah, I was. They were not allowed. That's what I'm following up. But, and because they were told it would be, you know, extraordinarily damaging to the reproductive organs and they could, you know, suffer uterine prolapses and their uterines would fall out. Well, you know, we've sort of forgotten about that. Now it's gone. Now, not only are women, you know, running marathons, but they're like kicking ass in ultra marathons. The same thing with the whole thing with running shoes, too. We're told this stuff is scientific truth, and it's just not. It's just stuff they made up, and we believed it. And again, what's so encouraging about that is that once we open the doors and let everybody in, let them do their thing, we start to see two things. Number one is the differences between us just start to shrink, you know, between young and old men and women. You get out of an ultra race, you don't know who is going to be up in that top 10 pack. It could be anybody. It could be a 65-year-old, but an older guy, or a woman, or some guy who's new to the sport. And the second thing about it is it just creates a feeling of community and camaraderie where, you know, it's not like other sports that are so male-dominated. It's when you're out there in the woods, you know, you're crewing for everybody, you're cheering for everybody, you're running with anybody who's next to you, and the differences between us just seem to vanish.
You know, and you told a story in that TED TV interview that I was not aware of. I didn't know the story of Duarte Tulu. I don't even know how to say that, her name.
The women and the
Tulu.
Mm-hmm.
How she was up there with the woman that was favored to win, and she was having a bad day, and this other racer stopped to help her twice, right?
Yeah, that woman who was favored is a little unknown, called Paula Radcliffe.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
Paula
right.
Radcliffe. And, you know, it's funny because you can actually watch a video online of the race, and the commentators at the start of the race are basically saying, look, it's Paula and the rest of you losers. And he was such an overwhelming favorite to win this race. And, you know, you hear the commentators just, she's the sharp edge of the spear, she's the lean machine, you know. And then what happened is throughout the Tulu, who at the time was in her late 30s, she'd had a really difficult childbirth the year before. She was about to retire from running altogether. She'd not won a marathon of any kind in about 8 years. You know, serious underdog in this race. And right at mile 22, just when, you know, basically it's every man and woman for himself, you know, there was no such thing as an act of charity after mile 21.
Right.
Paula Radcliffe starts to get a hamstring pull, and she grabs her leg and slows to a stop. And Gerard Tutulu also stops and says, come on, come on, and pulls her along. Let's go. And actually gets her back into the race. But then, you know, Paula falls back and just waves her on and says, go. And luckily, you know, Dorothy Hulu's, you know, great act of charity was rewarded with a gigantic check at the finish line because she ends up winning.
Yeah, that's a great story. And you have a great website as well, chrismcdougall.com. We went and checked that out. You have a great deal of video instruction on efficient running gaits and styles and great articles that you have that you've placed on there. So that's a great resource. And we'll link that as well underneath your podcast on trailrunnernation.com so folks can get to it, because it's more great entertainment and great knowledge too. So good resource, Chris.
Well, it's been kind of cool because, you know, I came into this as a student of the sport, definitely not an expert by any means. And so over the past couple of years, there's been so much great information that's been coming out and great studies. And to me, it's all fascinating stuff that I personally use all the time. You know, when I came across that drill, the 100 up, I ended up writing a story for the New York Times Magazine about it. But this is a drill from the 1870s. I'd never heard of it before and researched it. So that's all the stuff I throw on the website, is whatever I come across that seems really useful that I've personally tried or looked into and found to be worthwhile.
What is 100 up? Should I do 100 up tomorrow? What is it?
You know, the 100 up to me was, you know, the book came out, and I started getting this avalanche of emails from people saying, okay, I read the book. Now, I went out and bought the Vibram Five Fingers, and I said, when did I ever say buy shoes? You know, I never did buy shoes.
Yeah.
But what was happening was people started to get this idea that all they had to do was take their shoes off, and their problems were solved. Or all they had to do was buy a minimal shoe, and suddenly they would become Ryan Hall. But there is a big disconnect between knowing what you want to do and figuring out how to do it. And I think for a lot of people who are on board with the idea that there are right and wrong ways to run, it's hard to figure out, well, how do you do the right way? What is the right way and how do you learn it? And what I found was this running drill from the 1870s called the 100 Up. It was developed by this guy named Walter George. Walter George was a guy who was locked up in his pharmacist job for 14 hours a day, and he came up with this drill. He would do it for 30 minutes a day during his lunch hour. At the end of the first year, he broke the world record in the mile. At the end of the fifth year of doing just this drill, he had every world record from the half mile to 10 miles. And he said it's all because of this drill. It's a very simple thing to do. Basically, it's like doing strides in place. But what it does is it teaches you how to lay on your forefoot with a gentle stride, how to keep your hips, your shoulders over your hips, over your knees, over your ankles, and to really lift your foot using your glutes and not drag your leg behind.
You know, in swimming, Chris, there are a ton of drills out there to make yourself efficient. You know, and I don't think I've run for a while now, and I don't have any, you know, drills that I go out and do. This sounds like a good drill to help tune up my gait and make me more efficient.
You know, I got to tell you, that's been my major beef with both the shoe industry, but primarily with the running information sort of conglomerate, you know, basically the running magazines, because it's always been about what to buy, you know, what you can buy, what you can buy, how you can cross train. And it's not about what to do. And there's one blogger who actually sort of went back through, you know, Runner's World for like 2 years worth of issues. He's like, you know, there's nothing in here at all about running form. It's always inspirational stories and shoe reviews, but there's nothing here about how you actually move your legs. And I mean, to this day, it's still like a big point of controversy of whether there's a right way and a wrong way to run. To me, that makes no sense that that's even a controversy. There's a right way to do every other physical action. Why would there not be a right way to run? And if there is a right way to run, how do you learn it?
Agreed. And there's, I believe in the book, Eric Orton was somebody that you worked with, and he has a website as well. Coach Eric, boy, I shouldn't say it if I don't know it, but he's going to be coming on and we'll have, I love editing. But Coach Eric is an instructor on efficient gait and how to run, and I know that he helped you.
Yeah, he's the first guy to even mention it to me, too. And again, strictly by chance, I'd come back from the Copper Canyon for my first assignment down there, and I had a different assignment from Men's Journal to interview this guy named Eric Orton from Jackson Hole, who had this innovative way of training multi-sport athletes. And so while I was talking to him, I said, yeah, you know, I met this wild dude down the canyon named Caballo Blanco, the white horse, and he wants to do this race, a 50-mile race. I'd love to do it, but there's no way I can run 50 miles. And Eric said, you totally can. And you just have to learn how to run right. And that was the first time anybody ever, and actually, I was actually a writer for Runner's World at that time, but nobody ever told me that there's a right way to run. They only told me there's a right path to have, but not a right way to run.
Interesting. You know, yeah.
And for me, it changed everything. Like, once I changed my stride, that was it. You know, injuries gone, and running became much more enjoyable.
Gosh, Chris, I'm with you on that, too. Probably about 2 to 3 years ago, I changed and just became more aware of being a four-foot striker and not on the heel, because I think we were lured into the heel because of those shoes with the big pads on the back, and everybody was doing it. And I look back at some pictures from races, and gosh, if I'm not a heel striker, you know, it's wow. I want to try to collect those and cut it, everything off below my ankles there. But I've enjoyed running with a more efficient gait and feel like I can run longer as I age. I think I have I can stick with it longer.
And, you know, Don and I met Anton Krupicka not too long ago, and we were complimenting him on his running gait. I don't know if you've ever seen Anton run, Chris, but there's a YouTube video of him running, and it's...
I've been running with him.
Okay, so, I mean, you know, he floats. He doesn't run. He floats. And we were asking him about that. We were saying, is that just something that's natural, or is that, you know, something you've learned? And it was interesting to know that he had to teach himself how to run properly. And he said this is how he did it. And, you know, it took him years to learn. And he says he still has to work at it.
Yeah, he went through the same cycle. He was always getting injured and going through orthotics and motion-controlling shoes. And he finally decided to go the opposite extreme, get rid of all the crap on his feet, and start to go down to, first principles. You know, it's funny, I went out to interview him when I was working the book in Colorado Springs, and we went for a run, and afterwards we went out to eat, and he left his running shoes in the back of my car. These were the rattiest, nasty-looking things. They were an old pair of Nike racing flats. These things looked like they were 20. It looked like, you know, Frank Shorter would have thrown them away in 72. And they were literally falling apart. Like the uppers are coming off of the soles. And I thought, well, he's not going to need these again. So I drove off in the car. And, like, the next day I get a call from, you know, Tony, like, frantic, like, can you get my shoes back to me? And I couldn't imagine if anybody could actually run in those things. But it really was an eye-opener for me that's all you need. You need a little bit of protection for the bottom of your feet, and you're good to go.
Well, you know, all of these great things we're talking about is in that chapter 28. And then there are so many great stories in that book, Chris. Well, no, we just hit on that one chapter, but... You know, as you go through there, you'll be entertained and educated throughout. So we haven't told all the stories within the book. You know, there is just great, great entertainment, and one you just want to listen to or read once. It's a great book.
And as a matter of fact, I would think that a lot of our listeners probably have a copy. If they don't, they're probably Googling it on Amazon or looking it up right now to find out where they can get it, which, by the way, it's on paperback now, so you can get it a lot less expensive. But if you haven't read it in a while, like myself, I really...
Yeah, I mean, it you know, again, not to over-dramatize it, but it gave me back the use of my legs. You know, I was not a runner when this whole thing started. I'd been told by doctors that running is about the stupidest thing I could do. That I was too big, and the impact was too bad for me, and too damaging. And, you know, now it's just a whole different experience. Like I said, I can just, you know, dart out the door for a night trail run and think nothing of it.
Yeah, and as a last pearl of wisdom from that chapter, that wonderful chapter 28 in the book, you say, just move your legs, because if you don't think you were born to run, you're not only denying history, you're denying who you are. So thank you very much.
Sure, that was Dr. Bramble at work. That was a real great anthem he gave me.
Well, thank you much. Thank you very much, Chris, for coming on the show. We always enjoy talking to you. And congratulations on such a successful book, and thank you for the nation, our members, because I think we've all been motivated and enjoyed your writings.
Oh, guys, thanks a lot. I really appreciate these talks. I mean, nobody has ever appreciated that chapter 28 more than you have.
I think we plugged it enough times, don't you think?
Yeah, I didn't remember what was in chapter 8 until you reminded me.
You may have to go back and read it.
All other pages are there to protect chapter 28. That's my anthem.
Right. They are the pedestal for chapter 8.
Absolutely. Yeah. So thanks so much, Chris. We sure enjoyed it and look forward to seeing you on the trail. Look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Yeah, thank
you. My pleasure, guys.
Boy, the next time somebody asks me how crazy I am to go out and run these distances, I'm going to say, you know, I'm just living up to my ancestors.
Just living the dream.
Just chasing down the antelope, bringing back some food for the family.
I'm going for a persistence hunt. Well, thank you for joining us, Nation members. Go to the website, trailrunnernation.com. Join. Learn.